Chops TV.
You will be chopped.
Know what that means? Licking my chops.
Today I will show you how to do a karate chop.
Simply saying, no, he doesn't have the chops to do what it takes.
New thing. I'm busting chops.
Welcome to Chops TV, featuring Jennifer Lopez. Now here's Chops.
Happy New Year to all the Chops TV listeners. Well, okay, Jen. Chops and Jen here, as always. When are you allowed to keep on saying Happy New Year? I guess the better way to ask it is in the negative. When should you stop saying Happy New Year?
I've got a hard cutoff at Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. So the 16th of January.
Yeah, so, okay. Now, is that only for people that you haven't seen? Like, you continue? Like, once you say it to somebody, I think you can say it to the same person on both sides of the New Year. Like, December 30th, 31st, you see somebody,
sure.
Say it. And then you can see him again.
Post-Christmas. It's post-Christmas. Happy New Year. You could even still get in away with a Merry Christmas to December 28th.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, the 29th, I think, is when it switches for sure to, like, New Year's. We're done with Christmas. We're moving on. I mean, we're not done with Christmas. Our Christmas tree is still up.
It's year-round, baby. Yeah. Let's go. Christmas lives in your heart. Then it's never not Christmas.
That's in the Polar Express. Remember, the true spirit of Christmas lies in your heart. Well, it's not Christmas anymore. It's January.
It's not
now.
In our hearts.
Here's the problem. The holidays end, and then it's just winter. I like winter. I like the changing seasons. But once the holidays end, it's just cold and gray and wet. And we don't get real winter either. We get that kind of winter. If it was straight up winter and we had snow and I got to wear my boots and it made sense to actually wear a scarf, not for fashion, but for comfort and for heat, then I'd actually be more in on winter. It's this bullshit mud pile we get in Ohio where you don't see the sun for 3 months, it rains and it's spitting in your face, and I have to scrape my windshield every morning, but I don't get a brush off snow and get a nice little, that like glow in the morning. Even in the dark when there's fresh snow, it's nice and pretty. This is ugly and bullshit, and I hate it.
Well, Happy New Year, everyone. So excited to be back on the podcast. We got a couple things to talk about.
Starting with, let's just jump right into it because there's really no other way. So, okay. So what we're going to do is we're just going to drink up the bathtub on this movie and go for it. We watched Saltburn, which had a little bit of buzz when it kind of had like a limited release. And then I think it got a little bit of a wider release, but it was mostly a darling of the festival stuff, right? And then it comes out and then it finally ends up on Amazon Prime, although it took us forever. You were like, I saw it somewhere.
It's somewhere. That's what I, with a lot of these limited theater releases, then to streaming, I don't ever know where to find them.
Well, because they're not made by the people who own the streamers. They're picked up for the distribution by them. And there's really no, unless you're keeping up with like the trade magazine of all the festivals, how am I supposed to know that Amazon Studios versus Universal Studios versus Warner Brothers with Max, like that kind of stuff. How am I supposed to keep track of that? We just need to get a newer TV that allows you to search everything.
Like Apple sort of does.
But we don't have that, so we got to go through each individual app and find it. But we did find Saltburn, and as is tradition, it was your idea to watch this. So I'm going to turn the floor over to you to give a brief synopsis.
When has this... You know I'm so bad at this.
To give a brief synopsis to our listeners of... What is Saltburn?
See, why are you setting me up for failure? Okay, what is Saltburn? A boy, he lives.
Yes.
Not Harry Potter, but maybe in a different
life.
It's
actually Harry Potter-esque until it isn't.
Sure.
Which is British.
Okay. A boy goes to Oxford.
And wants to be a part of that upper echelon society, but doesn't know how to navigate it.
I thought I was explaining it.
Well, you weren't doing a good job.
I told you what it. A boy goes to Oxford, and he likes another boy, very popular boy, very rich boy, who everyone loves, this man.
Mm-hmm.
Then the man turns out he's got a heart for sad little other British men who don't have friends. So he takes them home with them for the summer to Saltburn.
A charitable millionaire. This family's probably at millionaire level, right? They're not billionaires.
Oh, probably not.
I don't think old money, I think it just kind of exists, but they don't really make more money so much anymore.
Especially not if you have those estates. It's a lot of money to upkeep.
Yeah, I mean, like, the Vanderbilts aren't even billionaires anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, the Rockefellers. Like, so when it's old like that, I put them in, but high class millionaire.
Yeah. And
don't really worry about money. It just, everything gets paid for.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, he goes to Saltburn. So then what happens? He goes to the estate.
You said a brief synopsis.
Okay. Well, then he kills the whole family, essentially, and takes it over. So how about that?
Spoilers. Yeah.
So that's Saltburn in a nutshell. It's a pretty... Is graphic the right word, in a way? Like, without... It's like theater of the mind. It's like graphic in that sense. That, no, what they're technically showing, except for the one scene with the sister, isn't all that, like, shocking to see. It's just, like, cringy, and you also can't look away. It has that car accident feel to it.
Yeah, there's a word that I'm looking for, and it's not, like, thought-provoking, which it is in some regard, but it's shock value isn't it exactly, but it toes that line of absurd, like, surrealism, but also
very grounded,
like, shock time. But also, like, shock value too. There is things that are supposed to make you, trigger you, to make you uncomfortable.
Yeah. And while we're on that subject, I would say that I think it went a bit too far trying to get the shock value. That was one of the things I took away from it. Like, I was intrigued by it, and we almost were like, do we need to watch it again? And I don't know if I really want to watch it again, or that soon. It does kind of feel like a movie that you watch once, and it's something. You get something out of it, and it's thought-provoking, and we were talking about it for days following the first time we watched it, but I don't know if I'm ever going to turn it on again, because to me, the sexual stuff reached, like, is this director got fetishes? That's where it was for me, and it's interesting, because the... What's her name? Emerald Fennell. She directed Promising Young Woman. I really liked that movie. I think she got a little far over her skis on this one. I think Promising Young Woman was definitely a subject matter that she felt a lot more comfortable in and felt like she knew what she was trying to hit. This one, I think, misses the mark. I don't even know if the movie knows what it's going for at times, but the sexual stuff just went... To me, it just pushed the envelope just enough to where it's like, we get it. He's drinking the semen-filled bathwater. We get it. He's rubbing her menstrual blood on both of their faces. It's been on the screen for 5 minutes. End it. Yeah. Or do you just want to see this? That's what it felt like to me. That, like, this, like, turned this director on and really wanted to see it on film. Because when stuff gets weird, that's... A lot of times what a director is actually doing.
Yeah.
They might only be subconsciously doing it, but it is what they're doing. And so I don't know that for sure, but I am accusing it. Yeah. I'm going that far to make it an accusation.
Yeah, I was saying, I don't know if I agree with you entirely. This might fall under, like, the argument camp of art for art's sake, or, you know what I mean? Or does it cross that line too much? I don't know where I ultimately fall on that, but... I think...
You can't just hide behind its art, though, in my opinion.
I know.
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I agree with you, but at the same time, I don't really know what my stance is on those scenes in particular. I know how I felt watching them, and I wanted to throw myself off a bridge.
Yes.
So if that was the intent, mission accomplished.
Yeah, you wanted it to end, but you couldn't look away.
Yes.
As far as the rest of the movie goes, I think another part where it really feels like it misses the point is there are two twists in the movie. And the first one is very earned and very good, where the Felix character, he has lied this entire time, right? It's Felix and... No, Felix is
Barry.
Jacob Elordi. Oliver.
Oliver.
Barry, yeah. Barry is the real person, his real name.
Right. Okay, right. So I knew that. Yep.
Oliver has been lying this whole time to get closer to Felix, and Felix finally finds it out, and that's at the same time that we find it out. And I think they set that up. I think they set that one up really well with all the lies. And I thought his dad was dead. I didn't have any way to think that. I thought his family life was horrible, that his parents were both addicts and that this was tough for him. And then he got this chance to receive this charity from a very wealthy family and spend summer with them after being at Oxford, but on scholarship. So he felt ostracized by the kind of the main part of the student body. Then it goes to the point where he gets mad because Felix doesn't want to be around him or be with him either as a friend or in a sexual partner type way. And he murders him, and then he starts sabotaging the whole family, setting it up so that the sister kills herself. But I don't even think they made that clear, that he didn't do it and set it up, that she did. And I think the intention, as I've read more, is that she killed herself. And maybe there's more in that conversation. Again, maybe in a rewatch we'd get it. But either way, I don't think that twist is earned. And then they're like, oh, actually, he popped his bike tire. That's how they had their chance meeting. He did this. He set up this. And it's like, you didn't, to me, give enough evidence for that to be an earned twist. All of a sudden, he just decided he was killing this family, which couldn't have been his initial plan because he loves Felix. Everybody falls in love with Felix. That's the problem with that character. Not in like a, it was a bad character. I thought it was a really good character. But that's the problem with that person, is that like everybody is drawn to him, and that's too much for one person to handle, and two, for the people around him to handle, because he's pushing them away too, because you can't be best friends with every single person. But yeah, that second twist of he actually set all this up and this was always the cogs in motion. No, I don't think the movie did a good job setting that up. It wasn't a shocking twist. It was just a, oh, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's, I definitely agree with you. And after we watched the movie, I was trying to sit with it for a little bit and decided where I ended up on it, either positive or negatively. Like, would I recommend this movie? And ultimately, I didn't think that I would, because like you said, I didn't really understand the intention of the movie after the last 7 minutes of the whole movie. So they do a really good job planning out and planting the seeds of that like first betrayal, quote unquote, because Oliver starts to manipulate and lie to the people in the house, and you understand that there's something more nefarious going on with him, and you know, just this like trying to lead Felix away from those people and stuff like that, distance him from the rest of the people at Saltburn.
He sets up the whole Farley thing and making sure that the family's like, oh, you're trying to steal from us in a way. Apparently, it's all based on that Sotheby's like auction art clearinghouse, whatever those are called. Mm-hmm. And oh, they think that Farley is trying to sell their stuff for money. So I mean, there is stuff in there, but it all feels like in pursuit of Felix. And then I guess he turns when he can't have Felix.
So okay, right. So the turning is fine. If it was like a crime of passion, that's one thing. But at the end, we're led to believe that this was a plan from the start. So it turned from like a, you know, heat of the moment crime of passion thing into a, no, this was like a calculated effort, but there was nothing in the beginning that showed that Oliver was like, you know, eat the rich, I'm targeting this family specifically, this estate specifically.
Or like incredibly brutal, you know, a lot of times the shorthand for like, oh, this person has the capacity to kill others is they are mean or abusive to small animals. There wasn't something like that. And as you go through the movie, it like the choice to then all of a sudden be like, I'm going to take over Saltburn. I saw in one of the reviews I was reading, and I thought this was the great point. He should have killed everybody else except for Felix and then forced Felix into a life of solitude with him. It, like, that would in make more house, sense. I'm not saying that's how I would write it or anything, but that would make a lot more sense.
No, yeah, I agree with
that.
What,
he wants to be alone and dance naked in a giant house? Where did that come from?
That euphoric moment at the end is the thing that ultimately tipped me to the other side of like not understanding what the intent was, because he is elated at the end of it at this long con plan that took what
15 years,
right? So like that was the confusing part about it. When did it turn from infatuation to my biggest thing was I didn't understand why he was so angry with the family, right? Like there was no real reason other than you know, he felt a betrayal from Felix after Felix decides that, you know, I can't have this crazy psychopath lying to me, staying in my house.
Looking through some things, I saw this on the Wikipedia page for Saltburn. It said, in writing the film, Fennell wanted to sympathize with unlikable people, saying, quote, the sorts of people that we can't stand, the sorts of people who are abhorrent, if we can love them, if we can fall in love with these people, if we can understand why this is so alluring in spite of its palpable cruelty and unfairness and sort of strangeness, if we all want to be there too, I think that's just such an interesting dynamic. And okay, that quote informed me a little bit more, but I did think that they hit that part right, that yeah, there is like a definitely like a disdain for the rich currently in society, and I would think I'm kind of one of them too. Mm-hmm. But they did a good job with those characters of being like, okay, but yeah, once you're like at their house and stuff, yeah, it's exorbitant and it's over the top, but they seemed like nice people. You get why people like mm-hmm. Felix, and there weren't too many moments of like, oh, they're just terrible people actually under the surface. I think they were just,
they're just like aloof, rich fox.
Yeah, they're like disaffected yeah. to yeah. the world.
Which is fine, but why wasn't the setup, I'm going to target this family. Oh, wait, I actually really love, like, I'm in love with this guy. And then it turns into like a, well, I'm already on this path. I'm just going to finish the job at this point. You know, something like that. That would have made a little bit more sense with the ending.
Yeah, I think maybe we do need a rewatch, but I just don't know if I want to go through that.
No, I think it's definitely not as bad as like Donnie Darko for me. Like Donnie Darko falls into the, I watched it once, I'll never watch it again.
You weren't a teenage boy when you watched Donnie Darko.
I guess I wasn't a teenage boy.
That's who loves Donnie Darko. That's why I like Donnie Darko.
Yeah, it's fucked. But yeah, this movie is also fucked. But I don't know. Maybe with some distance, I'll want to go back to it. Because it is an enjoyable... Well, is it enjoyable? I don't know. See, that's the thing. The parts
it's
that work...
It's mentally stimulating, which is something that I think people pursue. But that doesn't always mean that you enjoyed it or that it is something that you like watching.
Yes, but the parts that worked the best for me was that middle half, that middle portion where he starts to reveal more of his true nature in the way that he then tries to, like I said, manipulate individually
and using
each
sex
of these
to
people.
Do that.
Yes,
at
using
the same time.
Yes, using sex as a weapon, which is like a very in cinema anyway. It's a very like female heavy theme. Usually, it's like women using their bodies and stuff to manipulate dumb pervy men into doing stuff, but here,
well, that's what Promising
like,
Young Woman is.
Yes, but he like pushes this uncomfortability onto all of them in their own home and uses that as, you know, it to empower him. That was very compelling, very interesting, and I can see what she meant by like sympathizing and living with these like terrible, awful people doing like disgusting things, but then it takes it a step further.
Yeah, I still think it's one of those things where it's, I don't know this for sure, I couldn't find evidence of it, and it's, you know, kind of an art housey movie made by an indie director who had just had a very successful movie, so I don't think this is the case, but it had the feeling to me of when like a studio meddles and says like, ooh, we need to punch it up here, and you need to do this, and have this second twist so that people are like, ooh, look at that, there's like an action, like a final act thing, but I almost think the movie would be better, even though the first twist of him being a liar is more rewarding. I think that it would be better off if we actually knew he was like full on knew he was a liar, manipulative, terrible person, and not this sheepish boy. And then the second twist might make a little bit more sense. But when you reveal something that was that intriguing, like, man, he was just lying about everything the entire time, then the other stuff, like we were saying, falls flat and also doesn't really feel like the original motivation of the character anyways.
Yeah. Is it inappropriate to ask whose bathwater you drink?
I'm not going to answer that. What, you want to answer that?
I mean, there are a couple, probably. Off the dome?
I don't even like bathwater just in general. in any sort of capacity. So no, I'm not drinking any bath water. So there you go.
Well, you know what? The problem with that bath is, and it's a beautiful bathroom, but it's in the middle of the room. So where is the shower? Because I wouldn't take
Rich
a bath.
Rich people don't have showers.
What?
Rich people don't have showers. That's an elegant bathroom. That bathroom doesn't have a shower.
Yes, but...
that it's a bathroom. It's a bathroom in the true sense of the word. It has a bath.
Sure.
Showers are like in locker rooms and at the club.
No, they have rainfall showers now, and it spans the whole length of the
not
wall.
Not classy rich people. I don't know this for sure. I've never been to an estate.
What I'm saying is you wouldn't just like get in a bathtub. Then you're just sitting in your own dirt. You'd want a shower first and then bath.
Well, maybe the bathtub is in the wrestling room, which they mention, and in a very like homoerotic type movie. I was very surprised that that didn't end up being a scene. And to me, I understand showing the breadth of the house and showing all the rooms and all the dining rooms and look at how big the outside is. We have a hedge maze, all that stuff. But it was very specific to be like, oh, your room is right over here. In between us is the wrestling room. And he taps the door. And for me, I was like, oh, that's probably going to come up later. And I didn't like that from a screenwriting standpoint. And I'm not trying. Emerald Fennell is an infinitely better screenwriter than me. But you have such a finite amount of time in a movie that you shouldn't waste time with a detail like that that logs into people's heads. I would put it into not, you know the term Chekhov's gun. Of course you do. Mm-hmm. And then there's what I would deem Chekhov's car ride. I find it immensely distracting when a movie has scenes where they're driving around and there's never a car crash, because that's all I'm thinking the entire time. And sometimes it is for the suspense of it, because eventually there is something like that, or it misdirects you. But there are movies where there's just a fair amount of time where they're driving around in cars, and usually like dramas and stuff, and like a comedy, like road trip movie, I don't get that feeling. But if you're going to show me this much car riding, there has to be, for me, something there, or else it seems distracting.
So again, a point where we disagree. I agree with you on the car thing. Every time there's a car, an extended long car scene, I expect big crash, bam, boom. With this, however, to me, not an attack, but to me, it does seem like a bit of overanalyzing on your part. It was not even necessarily a throwaway line, but...
he taps his hands on the door and they both walk by it. He does a little spin move as they do it.
It was just a choice, Mark.
I don't know, man. I just... To me, I like it is a choice to include that line and to include all of that.
Yes, but through the walkthrough, he's like flamboyant, like showing off the house and stuff. And then at the very end, it's a great call back to when he's, flailing his arms and dancing around the house, going that same path through the estate. Like,
fair enough. But that doesn't change the fact that in the moment it distracted me.
Fair. Fine.
And I think that that's something that they could have avoided, because then in a weird movie where a lot of weird things are happening, I thought something was going to happen in the wrestling room. And then when it didn't, it seems like, okay, I was wasting mind power on that. And you don't want your audience to waste mind power on things that aren't important.
Yes, but
then they're not thinking about the movie.
And I do it to myself too. We are both guilty of this, but we're looking for stuff throughout the movie. We're trying to anticipate what the end of the movie is going to be, right?
Yeah.
Because we analyze, we think about it with intention, like, and we fall victim to sort of like ruining the movie for ourselves in that sense.
When you're somebody who watches not just this many movies, but this many like things on movies and reads about movies all the time, you do pick up just a little bit of like film theory.
Yeah, and it's just unconscious, and
Yeah. So, I don't know. The funny thing was, when we were discussing it, I was like, if this wasn't with such popular actors, Rosamund Pike is the mom, Jacob Elordi is huge right now, and Barry Keoghan is becoming a big name as well. He was in a Marvel movie. I was like, hey, this feels like a movie that would be like ripe for like, let's take it back to America and remake it again in like the Northeast and stuff. And I thought it was funny, because then the next movie we watched was not like Saltburn, but it was in the Northeast, higher upper crust, elite school world. And we watched what ended up being our last Christmas movie. And
well, maybe also New Year's Eve movie.
Maybe also a New Year's Eve movie. But I would argue that obviously it's important to the conceit of what the story is. But and I wouldn't mind if we wanted to watch it next December because I really, really like the movie. But it's not a Christmas movie in the sense that like it has to have everything Christmassy. Does that make sense? I don't know exactly how to put that out there without saying that it isn't a Christmas movie because it is. But
well, the Family Stone is a Christmas movie, but
Christmas is
the backdrop of it.
Yeah, it's not quite to the level of is Die Hard a Christmas movie.
No, but these people are here together because of Christmas.
Yes,
in the same way, these people are here at the school when no one else is because it is Christmas.
Recency bias for sure, but it's definitely the best Christmas movie we watched this year.
Are you going to say the title?
Of like ones that... have I not said The Holdovers yet?
No.
No. Fuck. The Holdovers. It was great. It stars Paul Giamatti. There were some other great performances in it. It's a really secluded movie, so there's only really three main characters, and then other characters pop in and out of scenes, but not only the best Christmas movie we watched this year of the new ones, possibly my favorite movie of the year. I really liked it. I found it, as we were talking about, like mentally stimulating, but in the good sense, where I would like to rewatch it. I would like to recommend it to people. I would like to hear what other people have to say about it. Saltburn does not give me that feeling. After watching so many made-for-TV/streaming Hallmark-type, Netflix-type Christmas movies, it was almost a relief to see something that was written so I wrote it down. I had an exact way I wanted to say with such articulate and grandiose but not inaccessible writing, and I really enjoyed it. It's a talkie movie. That's pretty much it. It's very few action type pieces. You know, he does the flip and hurts his arm. There's a few things. there's some physical comedy when they're. It's really all in that scene.
Yeah.
Mostly because when they're trying to get the car and he's trying to scrape it, like there's some flourishes that way. But it's very talky, and I didn't find myself being like, okay, when's it gonna end? I just really enjoyed it because I think it was expertly written.
Yeah, I was definitely along for the ride the whole time. If it's not based on anything, it's definitely going to get nominated for Best Original Screenplay.
So it's not. It's so I looked into it. So the screenwriter is David Hemmingson, who actually was somebody who he's from Connecticut. He went to the Watkinson School, a boarding school in Hartford.
Oh, the Watkinson School.
Then he went to Yale University. Then he graduated from Columbia Law School. Then he started to work for Loeb & Loeb Law Firm in Los Angeles before deciding to pursue a writing career. And his writing career is so weird. It's a lot of television. But the first show he worked on was The Adventures of Pete and Pete on Nickelodeon. Then he wrote for 101 Dalmatians, the series. He did 9 episodes for that. Then he does a ton of TV. This is the first movie he has written.
Wow.
Which is really impressive, but it makes sense because it's a lot of probably his own experiences in his own life that he can filter in through there without having to like do the research of what these boarding schools are like. He just kind of knows what a lot of that stuff is.
He knows what those jerk-off waspy boys are like because he was a jerk-off waspy boy.
Oh, man. Those kids, they expertly acted by them. Again, the writing is really good. But yeah, in the beginning of the movie, there's 5 of holdovers, and then one of them can't get away, and that becomes the main character, and he has to hang out with Paul Giamatti essentially the entire movie.
Now, back to overanalyzing things or watching media, but you know, not consuming the media in the moment. At the beginning of the movie, I was like, okay, they're at a university. There is a lot of snow. It is clear that they are in a snowy environment at some school that has to be on break. So in my head, I could not get out. Okay, well, where are they filming on location? How long did this film shoot last? And 3, did they have to shrink it down to be able to film at a university while the kids aren't there?
And also while they find the right pocket of time where there's that much snow. The shots are way too large and too big, like all the establishing shots, because they want to show the seclusion, so they take these really wide shots at certain points, and it's all snow. And not just like oh, it snowed here and it's cold and it's not melting. It is covered in like a foot of snow. It looks beautiful, but that's also, I know in the Northeast it snows a lot, but that's a very specific thing to need.
And for a very movie. Specific time.
Yeah.
Very, very specific. So those were the things that I could not shake out of my head while I was trying to be engaged in the first like 10 to 15 minutes of this movie. But once I got past that hump, it was really, really enjoyable. Just like, just, you know, 2.5 hours of me following this kid and this drunk guy and this lunch lady woman. It was very, very nice and sweet and wholesome also.
With also the flourishes of what is really dramatic through the story. And I don't want to spoil what like happens at the end, but some of the stuff within it, where it happens, because obviously they spend so much time together and they both start to see each other. And there's a very clear arc for the kid, but for Professor, whatever, Mr. Hunnam, played by Paul Giamatti, like that one is really cool. But I don't want to go over like what they talk about when they go on their field trip and everything. I want people to experience this movie. I think it's really intriguing. But one thing I did want to go over is the lunch lady. Her name is Mary Lamb, and her son had been able to go to this elite boarding school because she works there, but he wasn't able to then follow his classmates to the elite colleges in the Northeast, and so he enlists in the army and he dies, which presumably Vietnam. It's 1970 in the movie. We hadn't said that yet, but yeah, it's based in 1970. And I can't figure out why, but her name is Mary Lamb, and I was like, what about her situation has to do with the song Mary Had a Little Lamb? Because it seems intentional. You didn't have to name her Mary Lamb. So I looked up the lyrics to Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Okay.
And you tell me if you can, because I've read them three times.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say this is, again, another symptom of you / me overanalyzing, but continue, sir.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow.
Sure.
And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Okay.
He followed her to school one day. Okay, so here's the one where it's maybe something.
Mm-hmm.
Which was against the rule. It made the children laugh and play to see a lamb at school. And so the teacher turned him out, but still he lingered near and waited patiently about till Mary did appear. What makes the lamb love Mary so? The eager children cry. Why Mary loves the lamb, you know. The teacher did reply. And now that I'm reading it for like a fourth time, I'm thinking that the holdover student is the lamb, and she has an okay affinity for him and has to teach Paul Giamatti's character to be like, he's just an okay kid. Like, yeah, they're all shitheads, but this one is a little less of a shithead. That, again, that just came to me, but I just feel like there has to be something in there if they named her Mary Lamb. Not a distracting moment in the, you know, the opposite here. It was just something as I was thinking about it and looking more into it. But do you have any take on the lyrics of Mary Had a Little Lamb, the nursery rhyme, and the character in the movie being named Mary Lamb?
No, none at all. It never occurred to me. I never once thought about it.
Do you like my take there?
No, I don't. I don't. I award you 0 points. May God have mercy on yourself.
I don't even get points for trying.
I don't know. A reach. Back to the movie, though. Talking about living with unlikable people, both the teacher, Paul Giamatti, and the student are extremely unlikable. Everyone in this situation, except for, you know, the two children, are very unlikable.
Yeah, even at the beginning, Mary's, I mean, she's grieving because her son had just died. That's when they hold like a service in honor of him, or at least honor him during
like
their
final
service.
Closing Christmas, and then they honor him.
And so you know that about this character, but because of that, she's pretty closed off at the beginning. It's very, it never gets warmer. It's always winter in the movie, but the characters get a lot warmer throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because they get drunk all the time. They got a beer jacket on. Well, they never really drink beer. There's a lot of reference to Miller High Life, which I like.
Champagne and beers. People forget.
Maybe that's why I like the movie so much. One more thing, the director is Alexander Payne, and he's interesting to me because he's one of those guys who like only ever like 3 years or so directs a movie, and a few that stood out to me looking through it. In 1999, he directed Election. That's a Reese Witherspoon, Matthew Broderick one. About Schmidt is a really good movie. Kathy Bates is in that one. I haven't seen that in so long. That came out in 2002. 2004, Sideways, the movie with Paul Giamatti, they're in Wine Country and everything. Then The Descendants, that's one that I'm not too sure about. That I off the top of my head, I do not know what that one is. But then in 2013, Nebraska, which me and Opa watched one of the last few times we were in New York. Downsizing, that's the Matt Damon one where they get tiny. Didn't like the turn of that one, but I thought the concept was good. And then The Holdovers. So not very often, but all of his movies do have a pretty high degree of aptitude, I would say.
It's also very stylized. I don't know if we'd mentioned that yet. It is extremely stylized, where even the credits are still rolling, as we're being introduced to this world and the landscape of this university. And
when you turn it on,
felt nostalgic.
Yeah, when you turn it on, it wants it to look like a movie from the 70s, to the point where you were even did you question whether you had turned on the right movie for a second?
I don't know what I thought, but even the transitions too were very old school.
Yeah. Maybe that's something he wanted to do. I want to direct a movie from the 70s.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to do it. And I think he nailed it.
Nailed it. Out of the park. 10 out of, yeah.
Yeah. 100% recommend The Holdovers. It's a Christmassy New Year's movie, but I don't think you have to wait for that. It's currently on Peacock. If you do have that, it's not that I didn't like Saltburn, but that's a very specific movie that I think you need to know who you're recommending it to. Mm-hmm. The Holdovers, as long as you are an adult comfortable with a rated R movie, I think you will enjoy it. I found it very thought-provoking and stimulating the whole way through.
Yeah. Paul Giamatti. Just a gem. Who doesn't like Paul Giamatti?
There's got to be somebody who doesn't like Gracie. Paul Giamatti. Oh, Frankie Muniz.
Gracie.
Oh. Why? Oh, didn't she meet him?
Yeah, she was in that Paul Giamatti movie where he turns into a fucking dog.
Okay.
She was at the, yeah, she buys a, she's at the Christmas shop or the tree farm.
Sure. Whatever.
I don't know. Weird things.
You didn't comment on, I said Frankie Muniz doesn't like him. Any Big Fat Liar fans out there? No?
Sorry, I was trying to remember why my sister knew Paul Giamatti. But yes, Frankie Muniz and Amanda Bynes.
True.
Big Fat Liar. Great film. Turns blue.
We should rewatch Big Fat Liar.
We should.
It's probably not as good as we were thinking and remembering it being.
There's one that came out right around, and it's the same thing. Someone turns blue in that one also, but I cannot remember for the life of me.
A few tidbits to wrap things up here. You started watching the Percy Jackson show. Got through.
I did.
4 episodes?
Yeah, so it's a weekly series, and I don't know when it comes out during the week. Sometimes I'll just go on Disney Plus and there's a new episode, so.
Streamers do need to do a better job of that, of on the page, it should say when the new episode, and it should be big, it should be bold.
Yeah.
I should know when to expect a new episode. But sometimes they do a good job with it, sometimes they don't, but it should be in the same spot everywhere that there's a show that is currently being released.
Yeah, agreed. So it's good. I'm surprised by how much I'm enjoying it, actually. So maybe we'll talk about it when it's over.
That's on Disney Plus.
Yes.
So as the streaming wars go on, you brought this across my attention from discussing film on Twitter, but a news story about Prime Video, that they are planning to launch ads on January 29th. So a new ad-free option will cost an additional $2.99 per month. Prime has never cost per month anything, right? Unless, Prime itself you can pay monthly or you can pay all up in the year, but Prime Video never really cost anything.
No, it was part of Prime. Part of the Prime luxury. Now, Amazon Music, not so much. Audible, not so much. You have to pay. But Prime Video has always been part of it.
And $2.99 is not as much of an additional fee as most of the other streaming services. That's pretty cheap to keep it ad-free, and you don't have to pay it. You can do the ads. But, wasn't inventing Freevee enough? Isn't that how you wanted to force people to watch ads? Because basically, Freevee is just, we don't trust this to be popular enough on Prime, so we're just going to make it have ads. My guess is Freevee was successful enough, and they're people are watching it. Let's just add ads to everything, in which cable has fully, it's been done. Cable has been reinvented on the internet.
Which, how dare you, okay? I already pay you, a hundred and however many dollars to get me my packages in 3 days or less. And now I have to pay to not see that. This is the difference, right? I'm okay with paying for the Disney bundle or whatever, because you get ESPN and you get Hulu and you still have the ads on Hulu, but that's fine. That's like $16. I'm already giving you so much goddamn money at the beginning of the year. Don't give me ads.
And Prime already encourages us to spend more money with your company. I know a lot of them are third-party products, but you still get a cut of that every single time. It's why Jeff Bezos, at one point, was the richest man in the world, and now he's, what, second or third at any given moment?
And you can rent or buy new releases. Like, isn't it enough? It's not my fucking fault that you made a shitty Lord of the Rings show and spent a billion goddamn dollars on a garbage product. That's not my fault. Don't make me pay for ads.
Which brings us actually a little bit to our next point, because the merger of Jason Blum's Blumhouse and James Wan's Atomic Monster has been completed. So they're coming together. Basically, I mean, that's just going to own cinematic horror, like as far as like actually being popular. There will still be indie stuff, but that's these two. This merger is basically going to produce everything that you see a preview for ahead of a movie. And you're like, ooh, that looks scary.
Besides A24, right?
Yeah, but A24 has a very different vibe than the Night Swim trailer.
No, that's fair.
But you're right. That's a fair point on that. But all I know is that now we have to support these movies, because James Wan is going to have more infrastructure around him in this Atomic Monster studio that he owns, or production company, whatever it is. And we have to make sure as a society that Malignant 2 gets made, and that we get to put that into our eyeballs. Because Malignant is the best horror movie of the last decade.
Yeah, give the people what they want, James. And the people being Mark.
You don't want to see Malignant 2?
I'd see Malignant 2. You're right. The first one was wacky doodle enough, zany enough that I would watch it, yeah. I'm not going to the theater, though. Let me be very clear about that.
We should have gone to see Aquaman, because Aquaman 1 is the reason that Malignant 2 happened. He made a couple of really successful movies, including a billion-dollar one in Aquaman, billion-plus-dollar one, and then the studio was like, okay, people seem to like what you make.
How many faces does she have?
Because nobody would ever sign off on Malignant, but they should.
But they should.
And they should continue to do it.
I would much prefer to see those horror movies versus The Exorcist,
which
whatever.
Blumhouse paid $400 million and planned a trilogy with that.
Ooh,
and
yikes.
I believe it was... I had the numbers up here in the article.
Oof.
Oh, you will get to the article in 13 seconds. Thanks, guys. That
I
was really...
hate that. Why do they do that? Why do they... Okay. If it's especially with new stuff, don't make me subscribe to the Columbus Dispatch. Just let me read the article about the cat parade.
So yeah, they paid $400 million and again wanted to do a trilogy. So there's more money that they're expecting to make if they go through with that. But Exorcist Believer only made $136 million, which is pretty good for a normal Blumhouse production. That's the idea. Spend $20 million on a movie and then it makes its budget back 5-6 times over. But that's not what's going on with Exorcist here. You know who's directing that trilogy? It's David Gordon Green, who just did the Halloween trilogy, which I like definitely a little bit more. You have, at best, mixed feelings about it.
At best.
I think the first one, the one from 2018, is pretty good. The third one is interesting in the decisions that they went. The second one is straight up bad. I talked about Malignant being the best horror movie of the decade. That one's probably the worst big budget horror movie of the last decade.
Yeah,
it's definitely most
really
disappointing.
Bad. It's so bad.
To keep our listeners on pace with what we are planning on watching in 2024 and what you might hear on the podcast, you did a good job of compiling this list. Why don't you throw out a few of them so that people know, hey, stay up to date with us, and these will likely be on the podcast.
Sure. One last thing. You said The Holdovers is probably your favorite movie of 2023. The jury's still out on that one for me. I really, really want to watch Poor Things. If anyone's seen it, let me know. I definitely want to watch that one, and then I will decide. Okay, so upcoming 2024 movie releases. This is like January to early April.
Fuck mean you, it's January.
Yeah, because fuck you, it's January. Mean Girls is coming out in a couple weeks.
Which is a musical, for those who don't know.
Yep. Argyle, but do we care?
I think it's going to be a train wreck.
I think so, too.
The ironic thing is I think there will likely be a train wreck in the movie because it's very action-packed. Mm. And, yeah, I do want to see it, but probably wait for streaming. Yeah. I don't think I need to go to the theater for Argyle.
Yeah,
And a CGI cat.
The cat is probably what's getting me into the theater, to be honest.
It's a kids movie made for adults?
I don't know what it is. Or it's an
adult movie made for kids? It has a weird vibe to it.
It does.
In the trailers. They also, 2 months ago, advertised the shit out of it, mm-hmm. and then it just disappeared, and it doesn't come out until February.
Yeah, it seems like a very old school like promotional rollout for this, too, where a week away from the premiere or whatever, it'll get shoved down our throats again. But they used to roll it out way earlier movies, but the promotional period for that has shrunk a lot. Also, Henry Cavill's in it. I would drink his bathwater. Next, we have It Ends With Us. That one's for the girlies.
Yeah, I don't even know what that is.
Colleen Hoover, Blake Lively, what could go wrong?
I know Blake Lively. I don't know who's Colleen Hoover.
Colleen Hoover is the author of the book, It Ends With Us. You know, those like...
books?
Yep. Okay. So next, Madam Web, the next big Marvel, well, Sony Marvel movie collab. But
also going to be a train wreck, but
that trailer.
But that one needs to be on the big screen, and I want to experience it with a theater. I want to know if they're confused or laughing. I don't think there is another option. I don't think they're going to be like, that was really good.
No, I agree with that. One that will be really, really good that I'm very excited about, probably my most anticipated movie of the year, Dune Part 2, coming in March.
In one of the episodes of Half in the Bag, they're talking about Dune 2, and Mike calls it Dune 2, more Dune, which I think is hilarious. I think they should. It's such a serious and grandiose movie that what if you just instead named it something silly? And it's still the same movie, but it's just named something silly.
Or like Dune 2, Duned.
To Dune, to Phoenix, I guess.
To Dune, to Sand, to Sand has to go in there somewhere.
What is the salt or whatever?
Spice.
Spice, yeah.
Spice melange.
To Dune, to melange.
Okay, so for TV.
And then the third one can be called Melange et toi.
Okay, for TV. TV, we have, I didn't watch the first season of this, but I think I might watch the first season of True Detective so I could watch the newest season of True Detective coming out. You didn't watch
the first three seasons of True Detective.
Yeah, but I don't care about the other two. I really just want to watch the first season. True Detective Night Country with our girly pop. You know, the one.
I don't remember who it is. I remember Mahershala Ali when we discovered that there was a third season.
What is her name?
Here, you keep talking, I'll figure it out.
No, she's in the Comet movie.
You keep talking, go to a next one, I will figure it out. This is what you do when you're on the air.
She's in the Comet movie, and her name is, she's friends with Mel Gibson. Well, I don't know why that came up first. She's also in the movie with Airplane. No, Panic Room. She's in Panic Room.
Jodie Foster?
Jodie Foster. Fucking Foster.
Oh, yeah. She's only been famous for 50 fucking years.
Just leave me alone. Okay. Next one. Mr. and Mrs. Smith remake, kind of, with Donald Glover. It's like,
do you
a,
like the movie?
Mr. and Mrs. Smith?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It launched, well.
It launched Brangelina. It didn't launch those actors.
No, I was trying to decide if it was a soft launch or a hard launch.
It was a hard launch.
Yeah, it was a super, super hard launch. Okay, the Netflix Avatar remake. Very excited for that.
Oh, The Last Airbender.
Yeah.
I was like, what do you mean remake? Aren't they making 5 sequels to Avatar still? Now it's got a series?
Manhunt on Apple TV, a historical drama, my bag, about the aftermath of the Abe Lincoln assassination.
I can get into that.
Fascinating. Yeah. Can't wait to watch that. Two video game shows coming out, or, you know, a second one for one of them. The Fallout series, which I hear a lot about Fallout, but I know nothing about, but people really like Fallout, so that's coming on Prime. I guess you might have to watch it with fucking ads. And then the other one is Arcane Season 2, which is like a League of Legends thing, which I've heard great things about, and I know a lot about it, but I haven't had time to watch it yet.
In on Fallout, not in on Arcane.
Okay, a big one for the girlies again. Bridgerton is coming out.
All right, I'll watch this one with you.
Colin and Penelope, I'm so excited.
Is it season three or season two?
Three, but they're doing that fucking thing where they...
release it in parts?
Yes, release it in parts, which we don't need.
They need to keep your subscription dollars.
So we've got Agatha, the Darkhold Diaries, which, again, my excitement has slightly dampened on it, but I will definitely be taking a visit back to suburbia.
Okay.
Then we have The Penguin on HBO.
The follow-up to The Batman, right?
Correct, with our bats, if you will.
What, really? Colin it's Farrell, right?
Farrell. Firth is Darcy. Yes.
No.
Yes.
No, Mr. Darcy is Tom Colin. From Succession.
No.
Colin Firth is in Love Actually.
Colin Firth was the original Mr. Darcy on the BBC version of Pride and Prejudice.
And does that one have Winona Ryder too, or am I thinking of Little Women?
You're thinking of Little Women.
What are books?
Interview with a Vampire Season 2. A lot of people didn't watch this one, but it's incredible. The Interview with a Vampire, AMC.
I kind of liked it, but you stopped making me watch it and I didn't continue.
So that means that you didn't really like it, but it's like... It's so, so, so good. We'll talk about it when it comes out. Invincible Season 2, Part 2 is coming out, which we talked about Part 1 on the podcast.
Boom, boom, boom.
Lord of the Ring, Rings of Power Season 2, maybe. But again, we establish who cares about that shit.
That first season, I'm sorry for Lord of the Rings fans. And I finally did the full watch of the extended editions a couple years ago. And the movies are better than how I thought. And it's not that into them. They're really good movies. But no, that show sucked.
It sucked.
It is not intriguing. I don't care about any of the characters. The action is just like, whatever. Like, I've seen all these kind of fights before. And it's worse now because it's more CGI. It's not Peter Jackson spending $1 billion making sure that it looks awesome. And Legolas doesn't even snowboard a door down a bunch of stairs.
Yeah, and
so
worse.
What's the point?
Worse, it's ultimately making me pay for no ads.
And then the reason that this Lord of the Rings show exists, or at least the predecessor to this show, which is... finally going to come back this summer, and you were very excited for it.
Early, it's like late spring, early summer.
Okay.
The premier product, House of the Dragon. Very, very, very excited. I will be the most annoying bitch about this in the weeks leading up to the premiere.
So there you have it. Happy New Year, everybody. That's going to be some of the stuff on Chops TV. Watch along with us, and they will be picking up as we continue the podcast, and I hope that you watch The Holdovers after I've recommended it. I want to hit it one more time that you should watch that.
Oh, yes. Share your resolutions with us, too. My resolution, get invited to more weddings, because I love an open bar.
And we're done. Our wedding, like, seasons are done. All our friends got married. Well? If we got divorced, would you come to my second wedding if I invited you?
Yes.
For the open bar,
right? For the open bar.
Same. So we can agree on that. Yeah. If we get divorced, we are going to each other's second weddings.
Yeah. You can even, I don't know, hijinx it. Try to release a badger in the middle of a ceremony or something. I don't care.
All right. We'll do a live Chops TV from your wedding. You probably won't be on it anymore.
With Henry Cavill?
Are you getting married to Henry Cavill? In a bathtub?
After I drink it, I think he won't be able to resist me. Drink it. The bathwater. His bathwater.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Chops TV is made possible by people who subscribe to podcasts and viewers like you.